perceptible in our voice or in video.
And so, without further ado,
it's there when I'm.
Broadcasting from deep in the underground, going where the rest of the media fears to tread, is Alex Hansberry on Outside the Box.
Welcome to again another very special edition of Outside the Box. I'm your host, Alex Hansberry. And as usual, we will be going where the rest of the media fears to tread or is too terrified to talk about. One of those things is something the media is choosing not to talk about at this time. It was convenient for a while to talk about Afghanistan and put images of terrorists up on the screen to usher us into a panic state of going to war. Well, Afghanistan and the problems there are not over. In fact, many of you know nothing about Afghanistan and did not know where it was on a map prior to 9-1-1. But tonight, I have Professor Zahir Wahab from Professor at Lewis and Clark College, and he will be enlightening us a little bit about what is happening in Afghanistan. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Alex, for having me.
Well, where should we start?
Well, start actually what you just said, and that is the Los Angeles Times had an article the other day talking about the other war, the forgotten war. There indeed is a vicious war going on in Afghanistan, but very few people are talking about it. Even when Condoleezza Rice was visiting Kabul just yesterday, there was very little coverage in the mainstream press. And yet, some 200 Americans have died. This year, 1,400 Afghans have been killed on all sides. In the last 24 hours, 26 policemen and army and five doctors and nurses were killed. Just before Condoleezza Rice was arriving in Kabul, four rockets were slammed into Kabul, one to the National Intelligence Building and the other one near the residence of the Canadian ambassador, and two in other parts of the city. And so this is like a full-scale insurgency and war, but there's very little coverage of it, and now people are being distracted with other things.
Okay, who are firing these rockets? Who are shooting these bullets?
Well, it looks like the main opposition is the Taliban and remnants of the Qaeda, and it seems the members of the Hizbi Islami. But the interesting thing was that the people who got killed in Kandahar, in the western part of the country, they got killed and ambushed on the main road, which is used apparently by drug dealers and drug traffickers. People do believe that there are also independent commanders and warlords, and in particular drug dealers, who don't like a strong, stable central government or a stable country. So then there are a lot of people who are becoming very disillusioned with the government in the slow process of reconstruction. So I don't think it's just one group of people, but there are many, many different people who don't like the foreign presence or who don't like the central government.
Let's go ahead and start with the beginning, where a lot of this started. And I'm not talking about 9-1-1. We're talking about, for example, 1973.
Right. Well, you know, Afghanistan has always been a monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
In the same family, the Muhammad Zahi family, who mm-hmm. belong to the Durrani Pashtun tribe, they have been in power for as long as the country existed, since 1747. In the 1960s and 70s, the world was moving forward, but Afghanistan remained to be one of the poorest and least developed countries in the world. But within the royal family and also in the country, the elite, of course, were becoming very disenchanted and angry with the monarchy. And so Daoud, Zahir Shah's cousin, who had been prime minister and also minister of defense, decided with the help of some leftists, the Parcham and the PDPA members, Daoud simply toppled the monarchy, who at the time was in Italy, and declared the republic and a new constitution and a massive program of reconstruction and national development.
Okay, let me stop you right there. When did you migrate to the United States from Afghanistan?
In 1969.
Okay, what were your feelings at that time and over the course of that decade of the monarchy?
The monarchy didn't do much at all, and I think in some ways they are to blame. The Muhammad Zahi family and the monarchy are to blame for the upheavals since 1973, because they didn't do anything. I mean, I can remember, you know, there was no electricity, no education throughout the country, no health care, no industrial employment, for example.
So what you're trying to
and
say is
people were very poor and very backward. And so, but at the same time, people were becoming aware of where the rest of the world was going, and including Afghanistan's neighbors.
So as you said, these lefties were conspiring, if you will, with certain people in the Russian government to... This was just prior to the Russian invasion, correct?
Wait,
this time
wait.
Period coming, we're talking about 1978 here.
Wait.
We?
Okay. Well, the monarchy was overthrown in 1973, and then... but Daoud also was slow in reforming. In the meantime, you had the emergence of a proletariat class and also the emergence of the national elite. And so Daoud was overthrown in April of 1978.
Mm-hmm.
And the PDPA, the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, declared a massive program of national reconstruction and development, such as, for example, freedom of the press, land reform, equal rights for men and women, literacy programs, education programs, etc. And this threatened a lot of people in the country, especially the clerics and the conservatives. And also, as soon as the PDPA took over, President Carter and Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the National Security Advisor at the time, began to organize against the PDPA, because this is the height of the Cold War,
right.
And Iran had been lost, quote-unquote, Nicaragua and other places. So Washington and its allies went to work, and this frightened the Russians. The Russians then moved in December of 1979.
What kind of infrastructure, and I'm talking about the army, was in place at that time in Afghanistan to defend itself from the invading Russian army?
Well, the Afghan army at the time was mostly also party members. The PDPA would have, they had the standing army, which was, of course, a continuation of the previous army. And Afghanistan always had a very good, well-trained professional army. They were trained by the Turks, by and large, and also by Eastern Europeans. So the PDPA's army was a professional army, but a lot of their cadres and officers were trained in the Soviet Union and the satellite nations, but also they had their own militias and people, party members, but that was not enough, you know. And so the PDPA government found itself sort of on the defensive and under siege, and this prompted the Russians, but also the Americans then were working inside Afghanistan, fomenting opposition to the PDPA government.
You mentioned Zbigniew Brzezinski. He was interviewed in January 1998, in which he was asked by Le Nouvel Observer of Paris, question, the former director of the CIA, Robert Gates, stated in his memoirs from the shadows that American intelligence services began to aid the Mujahideen in Afghanistan 6 months before the Soviet intervention.
Indeed.
In this period, you were the national security advisor to President Carter. You, therefore, played a role in this affair. Is that correct? Brzezinski answered, yes, According to the official story of history, CIA aid to the Mujahideen began during 1980, that is to say, after the Soviet Army invaded Afghanistan, December 24th, 1979. That President Carter signed the first directive, he signed that on July 3rd, 1979, for the secret aid of the opponents of the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul. So we're dealing with just coming out of the Cold War during this time and covertly aiding certain factions within Afghanistan to, say, hold off the Russians.
Right.
Now, this continued for a long time,
from 1979 to February 1989.
On paper.
Well, in
on paper.
Actuality,
well, actually, we're going to get into some of that later on.
But I think we need to point out that Pakistan and some of the Arab countries were fomenting trouble even during the Daoud time. And so people like Ahmad Shah Massoud, the commander, famous commander, and Burhanuddin Rabbani and Hizb-e Islami, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, they were even working against the Daoud regime because they didn't like the reform that Daoud was trying to implement. And Pakistan in particular was helping all three of these individuals and their allies. So there were a kind of mujahideen to begin with, and the Russian presence simply exacerbated the conditions and strengthened the movement and brought other countries.
Okay, so we're looking at a 10-year war from 1979 to 1989.
Yes.
And how many countries at that point in the Middle East had come to aid the Afghan people?
It was estimated that at one point, actually, 16 different countries were involved actively in Afghanistan on both sides.
For example, different races, not just Afghans. We're talking about Arabs, Saudi Arabians.
Saudi Arabia in particular. Saudi Arabia matched the U.S. contributions dollar for dollar.
Right.
Saudi Arabia and some of the other Gulf states, Iran, for example. China was involved.
Yes.
You know, even China worked against the way they were helping the Mujahideen. And so, and of course, the Soviet Union and its satellites, countries at the time.
So what motivations do you think that they had for deciding that they would help this small country? Just to fight Russia or something else?
I don't think that Afghanistan mattered a great deal. It never mattered, actually, in
just
the scheme of things. But it's a very strategically located country. It's its location that matters. It's a gateway to Central Asia, for example. It has been said that Russia has always wanted to sort of find access to the warm water through Afghanistan, and Afghanistan was the way. That's one way people explain this. And so it wasn't so much Afghanistan, but it was Afghanistan as a strategic location that would be very central to, say, it can be a hub of communication, trade, and so forth, and sort of revitalizing the old Silk Road. And it also became symptomatic of the Cold War, because the Russians had taught Americans a lesson in Vietnam. And Brzezinski earlier was quoted saying, convincing President Carter, saying, we need to teach the Russians in Afghanistan the way they taught us a lesson in Vietnam to get even. So it was symbolic of the larger struggle during the Cold War.
Okay. So moving ahead to 1989.
Yeah.
Why did the Russians not win the war? Obviously, they are much stronger than Afghanistan, yet there's so much support coming in from elsewhere to help and aid Afghanistan.
Yeah.
What was the main factor and critical point that the Russians may decide, you know what, it's time to pull out, we can't do this?
Well, I think essentially it has to do with the weakening of the Soviet economy. And the idea was that the United States and its allies wanted to, quote, bleed Russia economically. Russia spent a tremendous amount of money on the Afghan venture, and 15,000 of their people were killed. Countless were injured. There was opposition to the Russian invasion of Afghanistan in Central Asia in particular. Russia got worried because the Americans, the Saudis and Pakistanis in particular, actually were supporting the Mujahideen to even enter the Central Asian countries, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. But also, the United States managed to turn the vast majority of the Afghan population against the PDPA and the Russians.
And in particular, here in 1989, with no structure. And now, the story of Afghanistan is very tragic, 1989 in particular, because there was a temporary ceasefire. One group had control of the capital, and we're going to set down this government very quickly. The guns were picked up again, and they started shooting at each other all over again.
Right. Well,
But the thing is that people need to understand that people haven't before, you know, so-called terrorists entered the country, is you had all these different groups that pretty much saw fair game in Afghanistan that needs to be talked about that were coming from elsewhere, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, that had set up shop that held all these weapons and arms that the United States gave them, rockets,
the caves,
anti-aircraft,
Stinger missiles.
AK-47s, Kalashnikovs, and it goes on and on. So we decide at that point we're just going to leave, meaning the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, the United States left in April of 1992 because when the Russians left in February of 1989, the Dr. Najib government, who was the last of the PDPA leaders,
pushed little by little back to their home.
But Najib tried very hard to reconcile. In fact, he was willing to relinquish control, and he did eventually toward the end, toward the 1992, and he just went to the UN compound and, you know, abandoned. Mm-hmm. And so the Mujahideen moved in from Peshawar in April of 1992, and as soon as they moved in, they began to fight each other. Between April 1992 and the end of 1994, Kabul was decimated and destroyed, and some 50,000 of our best and brightest were killed by the Mujahideen themselves because they couldn't agree amongst themselves.
Some of the worst fighting was during that time.
Yes, yes.
And we're talking about, let's get into some specifics, some of the raping that was going on at the time.
Oh, horrible stories.
The murders, the stealing of young children, which happened for a very long time, and indoctrinated them into their armies. Yes. How many different factions are we actually talking about that were actually... Seven that were fighting each other during that time?
Right.
Okay. So moving along to 94, or was it 96, the Taliban had gained control of Kabul.
By September 1996. The Taliban did not exist even in our vocabulary prior to 1993 or so. Mm-hmm. And so when the Mujahideen fought each other, could not agree, the country was in a way on fire, and you had three or four different kind of currencies. The country was essentially dismembered because the Mujahideen could not agree amongst themselves. In the meantime, there was something else that the United States was very eager to do, and that is to access the oil and gas of Central Asia.
Yeah, we're going to get
into that. And the quickest way was through Afghanistan, but to do that, you need a stable, secure environment.
Right.
The United States became convinced that the Mujahideen could not deliver peace and security and so forth. The United States, Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan created and invented the Taliban.
Which is our next area of discussion.
Yes.
Osama bin Laden. Now, he was a Saudi-born with relatives that were like Salim bin Laden, which were partners with members of the Bush administration, various ones.
Yes,
senior,
the Carlyle
junior,
group.
Yes, including the Carlyle group.
Yes.
Now, he was created for their interests to fight the Russians. We understand that.
He worked for the CIA.
Absolutely.
Full time. Yes.
Now, when I had said earlier, when we had talked about funding, and you said it cut off, specifically, the CIA has a very close relationship with the ISI.
Yes,
the Pakistan Intelligence, as well as the Mossad and MI5.
Yes.
Now, without making this a 9/11 show, we've done many like that before. This isn't one of those. But we do need to cover the point that they were primarily the reasons why, the reason that Taliban took control of Kabul, because they were still receiving aid from the ISI or people affiliated with the ISI through that channel.
Indeed.
Right. What was the ISI trying to do to Afghanistan?
Well, the Pakistan has always meddled in Afghan affairs, partly because Iran has meddled and continue to as we speak. And there are a couple of reasons. One is that Pakistan, because of its differences with India, has always been looking for what is called the strategic depth, so that if Indian forces move into Pakistan, Pakistani forces will have a place to withdraw to, and that was Afghanistan. And that's one reason. The other reason is the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan has never been accepted by any of the Afghan governments for the last 100 years. That border, the Durand Line, so-called Durand Line, which was arbitrarily determined by the British, accepted by the Pakistanis, but the Afghans have never accepted that.
Right.
And so, and that, the treaty expired in 1992.
Okay.
So Pakistan does not really want a strong, stable government in Afghanistan for the reason that such a government would be demanding to the determination of not just the Durand Line, but pushing it so that Pashtunistan might become part of Afghanistan. Uh-huh. These are two reasons. And other than also ideological, uh-huh. you know, I mean, Pakistan, ISI has very close relationships with the religious elements in Pakistan and the conservative elements. And so they did not want a progressive government or especially a leftist-oriented government right. in Afghanistan.
The Taliban was perfect for them.
The Taliban was perfect because they were vulnerable, they were simple people, and they were put together. But it is important to state that Bin Laden moved first into Afghanistan from the Sudan mm-hmm. before the Taliban arrived.
Right.
And Bin Laden and his people, Qaeda, plane loads, were given visas and passports by people like Burhanuddin Rabbani.
Right.
The people we supported.
The name?
They're very, in Sayaf, for example, and others. And then the Taliban moved and took over Kabul
that
in September.
Was given by the CIA
yeah.
to Bin Laden was Tim Osman.
Uh-huh.
That was his handle. That was his code name. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is, I and many believed how Osama Bin Laden has been working for the CIA long after the war with the Russians.
I have heard that. Yes.
Again, that is another show. I can recommend you to many documentaries that will explain this to you in full detail with documentation. But what I'm seeing with the Taliban and the kind of government they structured, first of all, let me make this abundantly clear. The Taliban were not good guys. We understand
right.
that.
Right.
They didn't have the kind of morality that they pretended they stood for. However, the reason that we went in there, I'm talking about before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
There were interests to remove the Taliban. They had put all these images on CNN talking about women
mm-hmm.
and that we need to protect the women, yet we have our own problems here in this country that we haven't dealt with yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a lie. And it rallied a lot of people to fight this foreign enemy, but the problem is, when we'll get to that later on, associating Taliban with Afghans.
Right. Well, it would be wrong
mm-hmm.
because, again, Taliban were an aberration
mm-hmm.
in terms of the history, culture, religious orientation, and so forth, national solidarity in Afghanistan. But we need to point out that the Mujahideen were just as bad as the Taliban. The Taliban simply were...
Right. Explain the difference for my viewers at home, the difference between the Mujahideen
yeah.
and the Taliban.
Well, the Mujahideen were the first generation.
Mm-hmm.
These people that we put together, trained, funded, financed, supported, etc.,
right.
to fight the Russians and kick the Russians
the
out.
The Taliban were an offshoot.
The Taliban were an offshoot. That was the second generation.
Right.
The Taliban, some of the Taliban members actually fought with the Mujahideen against
right.
the Russians.
And they fought
Others
later
were mostly young.
Yeah, because
very
it was
young.
Really sad. Back to that time in the 80s, mm-hmm. after the Russians left, they were fighting each other because they had all these different ideologies on how the country should be run.
Oh, they destroyed the country, you know, the Mujahideen. I mean, they have done an incredible amount of damage. And they were the ones who brought Bin Laden and the Qaeda to Afghanistan. And
right.
in a way, they were responsible indirectly for the emergence of the Taliban, you see.
Mm.
And they were also responsible for the massive drug problem we have in this country.
Yes.
And dismembering the country along ethnic lines. I mean, these divisions were highlighted during the Mujahideen, the first generation. So,
the United Nations released some studies for the year of 2001.
Yeah.
Again, the Taliban weren't good guys. However, we have to look at the facts and look at things how they were. They had put a ban on poppies. The Taliban were known, as we know by now, for executions in soccer stadiums.
Yes.
And things of that nature. They had put the ban on poppies at that time because it was deemed un-Islamic. That was very interesting because it's pretty much been documented for a long time that certain aspects of Wall Street do peddle with laundering drug money. And that includes our situation with Colombia and Panama and places like that. So it kind of raises a question. Why would you be ready to invade a country right before 9/11 when they've just cut off the drug supply?
Well, from what we know, the decision to invade Afghanistan, either Afghanistan or Iraq, was made much earlier,
mm-hmm.
and it had nothing to do. If you read the project for the New American Century, for example, I mean, Cheney, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, Richard Piper, and these people, including Dr. Zalmay Khalilzad, our ambassador now in Iraq, previous ambassador to Afghanistan. I mean, these people had decided that Afghanistan would be invaded much before the 9/11.
Right.
In fact, there was a famous meeting in Berlin in July of 2001,
right,
where it was attended by the Americans, the Pakistanis, the Taliban, and the UN.
But
and the Taliban were told that
there were Russians in Uzbekistan.
Yeah.
Thousands of them on the weeks before 9/11. When we get back, we're going to talk about the things that were happening after 9/11. When we get back, we're going to try and get to some of your phone calls. But for now, we're going to show a quick clip from Exposing the New World Order, a film by Terry Milton. Don't go away. See you later.
It's World News Tonight with Peter Jennings. Reporting tonight, Ted Koppel.
Good evening. The Bush administration issued a new terror warning today. No information on what to expect, precisely where, when, or how. Just that something big appears to be in the works.
Thank you.
So the basic facts are, after 9-1-1, the Taliban was basically coddled and shepherded and protected and basically were allowed to leave Afghanistan, our supposed enemies, in this war on terror into Pakistan. That's documented now. You can pretty much read any newspaper and it'll tell you. But what happened after that time was we saw the drug trade go way back up and we saw proposed plans for a pipeline.
Yes.
What do you think about this whole idea of peak oil and the reason that, well, we're in there just to steal natural gas and build a pipeline?
Well, I know this much, that both Hamid Karzai and our former ambassador Khalilzad worked for UNOCAL. They were consultants and worked for them. And I know that studies have been completed, feasibility studies, to connect Daulatabad and Turkmenistan through western Afghanistan to the port of Gwadar and then beyond. And that work is going to begin later this year or early next year. Agreements have been signed between Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Turkmenistan.
What group or company, again, is going to be doing this construction?
I think it's a consortium, though. Okay. It's UNOCAL, a Malaysian company, and some Indian company, mm-hmm. and even Gazprom from Russia. Mm-hmm. But we'll see. But those agreements have been signed. The feasibility studies have been done. And now even India, when Prime Minister Singh was visiting Kabul, India would also like to then extend that pipeline from Pakistan to India itself. So I think this figures prominently in the thinking of the United States and the West. Again, it's not so much Afghanistan, but it's because it is so strategically located. And with peak oil and our addiction to oil and all that, we will need all the gas and oil we can get.
Senator John McCain had called for permanent bases, as well as many other people, for Afghanistan. If anyone remembers World War II, Nagasaki and Hiroshima, they're going to remember that we were there, we stayed there, we have a naval air base location there, and we're going to be there probably for a very long time. And if anyone really realizes, if you look at the map of the planet Earth, the United States and its allies and their interests, like the British Army, are basically all over the planet.
Well, I mean, we now live in a unipolar world, and we have one vast empire, and that is the United States. But looking on the ground, you know, and I have been going to Afghanistan even during the Taliban. Mm-hmm. I have visited because my mother lives there and my family. The United States is working on permanent bases. Mm-hmm. For example, in Kabul, in Kandahar, and in Shindand, in Herat. Mm-hmm. And many people think that in Afghanistan might become just like another Puerto Rico or the Philippines.
Right.
Because now that the United States has been told to leave Central Asia, because the Chinese and the Russians are very unhappy. Mm-hmm. You know, the organization of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, in a way, told the United States to leave Central Asia.
Okay.
The other five. So if the U.S. is forced to leave, the U.S. will need an outpost there in Afghanistan. It will be a very convenient place.
I heard some disturbing rumors last year about the elections, about them receiving things if they were to come and vote and participate in the elections. Do you know what I'm talking about?
The election to which
one? The last election in Afghanistan.
The parliamentary or the presidential?
Presidential.
Well, both elections. The presidential election, as you know, took place exactly about a year ago. Mm-hmm. And the parliamentary election took place on September 18th, this last September. And there have been charges in both elections that there was fraud, mismanagement, bribery, coercion, all of that. In fact, this has been admitted this year.
They were able to receive food if they came to the line.
Food or money.
Right.
And we know. And in fact, some people would go as far as to say that Ambassador Khalilzad, who engineered the two Loya Jirgas, the national town hall meetings, one to install the interim and transitional government, and the second one was to ratify the constitution, that Zalmay Khalilzad was lobbying these delegates of the people and actually bribing people. I have heard this. And so, but this time in these elections, we know for a fact, in fact, that all of that took place.
So where's the poverty level actually gone between, oh, 2001 and now?
A few people are doing very well. Mm-hmm. The drug dealers, the warlords, the criminals, the smugglers,
but here's the
parasites.
Thing. I got to interject.
Yeah.
We're the most powerful army on planet Earth. The Taliban was basically the weakest army. They were basically a guerrilla group. Now, they were able to stop the drug trade.
Yes.
This little ragtag group with rusty AK-47s donated from the ISI.
Yes.
We come in and we can't stop the drug trade.
But we need the drug lords, and we work with them very closely, and we depend on them. In fact, even American military commanders are on record.
Right.
I don't know if you saw Christiane Amanpour's program on the CNN. She asked this American commander and say, now, you are working with these drug lords and criminals and warlords. And the American commander said, we have to be realistic.
Right.
Because we need these people.
We have to be realistic, but just like Iraq and the situation with Iran, it's really easy to aid someone and say they are a good guy when they're fighting your enemy. We aid Saddam Hussein. He fights the Iranians. We aid Northern Alliance. They fight the Taliban. Oh, Northern Alliance. Yes, Northern Alliance. The same people that threw children that they thought were Taliban and many others. Many children have died in this tragedy in these boxcars, let them to fry in the sun. Northern Alliance were very ruthless.
Well, there's a very good documentary by Damien, the Irish journalist, on the CIA, and it's on film. It's on camera right there. American Special Forces and CIA people working with the Northern Alliance members and Dostum's forces and putting people away, you know.
Yeah.
But the point is that the coalition, so-called coalition forces, have not dealt with drugs. They drive through it. And as I said, the reason for that is because they need these people, because America, especially when the United States moved in on October 7th, 2001, they had very few people on the ground. They just had the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And so they hired these people.
Right.
In other words, the Defense Department outsourced the invasion of Afghanistan to these some of the worst criminals. Now, unfortunately, some of these known criminals who have really committed horrendous crimes are now members of the parliament. And the U.S. knows this. We know. I have a list here of these people, like Sayyaf, for example, like Khanouni, for example, like Muhakkik and others. They got elected. Drugs now, you know, it's more than half of the economy.
It kind of shines the light on the lie that we are better than our enemies, especially when you look at all these things and realize, well, it's not just the United States a part of it in the invasion of Afghanistan. I would basically call it that, as well as many other groups like NATO. NATO has got thousands of troops in Afghanistan. And they just, in another report that just came out today, 12 hours ago, they're not going to go help aid in Pakistan because they have to stay there.
Yes.
Well, if these people are free and sovereign, why, according to the lie of the White House, do they need us?
Well, this is the point. The point is that, you know, the United States will embark on these ventures and then outsource the war. And so the U.S. now is putting a tremendous amount of pressure on NATO to assume counterinsurgency in Afghanistan, because the United States is now thinking about withdrawing some of its troops from Afghanistan. And NATO, you know, Germany, France, and Spain don't like the idea of fighting the insurgents in Afghanistan. They will do peacekeeping. They say, we'll see what happens to that arrangement.
Okay.
But here's another example, you know, outsourcing, just the way, you know, in Iraq, we have thousands of mercenaries, as you know, the United States Army.
Mm-hmm.
They hire these mercenaries or people who are trying to get an ID or a green card. They send them to Iraq. And then they will say, we will expedite your citizenship. And they're doing the same thing in a way in Afghanistan, and that is to turn this over to NATO, but NATO is not very interested in this.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious what your thoughts are now that we've covered all that information about the future of Afghanistan. Is there hope for Afghanistan, the people, to rebuild their lives, rebuild their cities, and move on?
Well, I have been going to Afghanistan, as you know, for the last 4 years. Every year I have spent about 5 or 6 months in Afghanistan. I speak both of the languages. I look like an Afghan. I talk to all kinds of people, and I live where the common people live. And so I have a pretty good picture.
Pashto
and Farsi. Yes, I'm fluent in both. And I know quite a bit, I think. But also, if you look at studies done by Human Rights Watch, for example, Amnesty International, our own Government Accountability Office in Washington, D.C., or other organizations, Afghanistan is really sitting on a knife's edge right now. It could go either way. And that is, people are very angry with the slow pace of reconstruction. They're fed up with corruption, incredible corruption in all walks of life. this is why, you know, Mr. Jalali, the Minister of Interior, resigned, because he knows cabinet members who are involved in drug dealing, or he knows these governors and so forth that Mr. Karzai appoints or advises, etc., and he gave up. Right. And so if you go to Afghanistan, life is very hard. Again, it remains to be the poorest country in the world, the third poorest country. Mm. Highest illiteracy, for example, child mortality, maternal deaths, lack of... Kabul itself still doesn't have a single traffic light.
Right.
It doesn't have regular water or electricity. It has no sewer system, for example. The roads are unpaved, and there are 3.5 million people making a living. And this was why half of the population turned out for the election. In Kabul, only a third of the people voted this time. And people are demonstrating. In fact, there were demonstrations today, for example, right at the palace, at Karzai's palace. People looking for work, for employment, and they're fed up with, say, corruption and this coercion by warlords. So unless there's, and the international community has only contributed about $4.5 billion in the last 4 years for a country that was destroyed for 25 years. $1 billion a year is nothing.
What's it going to take for that country to have a product other than drugs now that it's a narco state? I read it's like they're in their range of exports in value of $433 million a year. That's nothing. What's it going to take?
Oh, yes, I know.
For them to actually have something sustainable for the people.
Well, there has been serious problems. This aid that comes in is all funneled through these 900 or so NGOs. Because the NGOs say they don't trust, right? They don't trust the Afghan government because you don't have capacity. There's dishonesty and corruption, et cetera, et cetera. So all of the aid, say, from Japan or the World Bank or the IMF would go through these NGOs. And the NGOs simply will not account for anything.
Right.
And 80% of the money, it's estimated, 80% goes to overhead. I mean, there are people who get paid $1,000 a day in Afghanistan,
right.
These NGO people. Mm-hmm. Cars, homes, et cetera, et cetera. So there's not much money left to be spent on the ground on education, healthcare, agriculture, roads, et cetera, et cetera. So at the same time, the United States has so far spent about $60 billion on the military operation. The U.S. spends about $1 billion a month on the military operation, but less than $100 million on technical assistance. And so you need to rebuild the economy, industry, but very little has been done. And this is what people don't understand. They keep asking Mr. Karzai, where is the reconstruction and where did the money go? And he really had no answer.
You had some thoughts about higher education and some projects you're working on in Afghanistan right now?
Well, this is what I've been doing, basically. I mean, I have been an advisor to the Minister of Higher Education, one from Herat, the other one from Hazarajat. And higher education, like everything else, has been destroyed in Afghanistan. I mean, this is a country, you know, that was at war with itself and then invasions and so forth for 25 years. And so we had to really build and rebuild higher education from zero, from scratch. Mm-hmm. faculty development, classrooms, water, electricity, laboratories, labs, workshops, chairs, for example, campuses. I mean, we have virtual universities there with the universities with no campus, for example. And imagine we have about 2,000 faculty. Only 6% have PhDs.
What kind of interest does the United States have in building universities and building high schools for girls, for example?
Well, right. The United States, for the first 2 years, 2002 and 2003, it helped with elementary and secondary education, some teacher training, textbooks, building schools, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And we kept telling them to rebuild higher education because it's the surest way to have this country stand on its own feet. You need to train a bureaucracy, for example, experts and technical workers and so forth. And so for the last 2 years, they have been helping with higher education. For example, there are multi-million dollar projects to improve teacher education, for example, build campuses, improve the schools of engineering and agriculture and so forth. But Afghanistan, unfortunately, right now, there really is no human capacity, but also there's very little money. The Ministry of Higher Education, with about 40,000 students, 2,000 faculty, 7,000 employees, had an operating budget of $9 million per year, operating budget. And 60% of that money goes to feeding and housing the 14,000 or so students. One problem that is happening in Afghanistan is that demand for higher education is exploding, but the government's capacity to deliver higher education is still in the same place. Mm-hmm. And so we always had demonstrations, and the ministry was actually, invaded twice or three times by students who were just angry, and we had no space for them. So that's what's happening.
Well, we're going to take your phone calls at this time. You can go ahead and give us a call at 503-288-4442 or 288-4448. Please keep your questions limited to the topic of this evening. We will be back to the regular programming next week. But, you know, this is an important topic to discuss. You know, for example, there are many that showed great concern about Iraq now that weren't necessarily talking or being a part of the anti-war movement prior to the invasion, because it was pretty much considered status quo or okay to be a part of the political bandwagon.
Yes.
It's pretty much in vogue to be a part of mainstream left anti-war movements. And Afghanistan is not gone. We have to continue to discuss it like we are right here.
There was a reason why I brought the picture of this girl, this little girl who's now a mother and getting old. She, in a way, epitomizes Afghanistan, symbolizes. She is sort of the metaphor for Afghanistan. Frightened, ravaged, savaged, uncertain, anxious, and hopeful. And this is how the country is right now. Afghans are very concerned about, again, the possibility of being ignored, neglected, and forgotten by the world. And if that happens, there will be civil war again and never end. And that's why I think it's essential for this country, and that goes for government and activists and people in between, not to forget Afghanistan and to work toward massive infusion of capital, expertise, technical assistance, and so forth, so that the country can build itself.
We have a call. Go ahead and bring him on.
You're on Outside the Box. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Do you have a question?
Okay, great. Yeah, actually, I'm also Afghan, and I spent this past summer in Afghanistan working at the Wazir Afzal Khan Hospital, which I'm sure you guys are familiar with. And this is the first time I've been to Afghanistan after, God knows, 20-something years. So my question to you, Professor Wahab, was, what do you make of what a lot of people were saying when I was out there, that there has been a lot of money promised to Afghanistan, but that hasn't been delivered, both from agencies from the United States and from abroad?
Right.
In particular, I wanted to also comment on the lack of presence of the United States relative to ISAF and the German government and things like that. So if you could comment on that.
Yes. You're right. And that is in the Bonn Conference and then the Tokyo Conference and then the other Bonn, countries promised about $10 billion to Afghanistan. But we know for a fact, and I was reading some figures, that thus far only about $5 billion have been delivered to Afghanistan. Countries get distracted. They forget, for example, and that includes countries like Pakistan, which has its own enormous problem right now. So one problem is that countries have not, or other agencies have not really delivered on their promises. And the second problem is that, as I said earlier, most of the technical assistance, the foreign assistance, is channeled through these NGOs. And NGOs are becoming extremely unpopular. In fact, Ahmad Shah Khalili, the vice president who spoke at the UN assembly, talked about this, that the Afghan government needed to control the foreign assistance that is coming into the country. ISAF, as you know, was responsible for 10,000 troops and now controlled by NATO, is to keep peace in Kabul, but also in parts of the northern Afghanistan. But now ISAF and NATO are under pressure from the United States to engage in counterinsurgency, and we'll see how that conflict is resolved.
Oh, wow. Were they ever taking any sort of a development role, ISAF, in those countries, or was it really just...
They have what are called these Provincial Reconstruction Teams, PRTs.
Mm-hmm.
There are 19 of these Provincial Reconstruction Teams, and what these are... They have, for example, some intelligence workers from ISAF and from the so-called coalition. Intelligence people, military people, and some reconstruction experts like engineers and so forth. So there are 19 of these throughout the country trying to build maybe schools or hospitals or help farmers with agriculture or building bridges and so forth. But the main work of the so-called PRTs really is to pacification, public relations, and pacification and intelligence. And that's why the other international communities, including CARE, for example, which is a very credible, good organization, they don't like this.
We have to get some more calls.
Yeah,
thank you. We're going to go ahead and go to the next call.
Oh, hello. Hello, Alex. Hello, Doctor.
Hey.
I just had a question. You had mentioned the natural gas pipeline there.
Yeah.
I wanted to see what your take was. I had read somewhere that Enron was building one of the biggest electrical plants in India. And I heard the very last comment you made was that, you know, they're planning on putting the pipeline through India. And is this another, you know, Bush, you know, type of deal where, you know, him and his cronies before Enron went down, you know, are trying to fund this natural gas pipeline to fund the India plant, which is, you know, the biggest one to pretty much cover the whole country or just a good part of it?
Yes, I've heard that one. I honestly don't know what Enron is doing, but I know this, that there are several American multinational corporations like Kellogg, Brown and Root, for example, or Lewis Berger, for example, or these other companies who are working, or Dyncorp, or Blackwater, for example.
Well, you know,
they are working in Afghanistan.
One thing's for certain concerning natural gas. Whether the peak oil or natural gas crisis is real or manufactured as far as limitation of resources.
Yeah.
Either way, many people on this planet are going to die this winter. They're going to be having to choose between eating and heating. And with that, we'll go to our next call. And that's the reality.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Go ahead, caller.
We have another call.
Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm...
Go ahead.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I'm from Portland, Oregon, listening, turned down my phone. I have one question about the last caller just called about the natural gas pipeline. There's a lot of people that disagree or agree on the fact that we went to Afghanistan to rid the country of the Taliban, but at the same time to gain natural resources and energy sort of resources. My first question is about the pipeline that, you know, a lot of people say no blood for oil. And in this case, we are building a pipeline across the country to deliver product through the one of the seas there and get it to the market easier.
Right.
I have a huge interest on to what extent that drove the invasion of Afghanistan versus taking out the Taliban. And my second question is about Afghanistan itself, and it's another caller asked about Afghanistan and what the potential is for really rebuilding the economy.
Okay.
And I understand that the professor said it was on a knife edge, and I've heard the knife edge so many times in all the course of debate about these certain subjects. Everybody's on a knife edge nowadays. What is the real, what is the,
What are the factors that determine the knife's edge? Is that what you're asking?
And no, what more can we do to get to a real
let's allow my guest to answer the first part of your question.
I had understood the second question, too. There's a school of thought which says that the pipeline, that the United States began to think about accessing the Central Asian oil and gas, including the Caspian Sea, right after the dissolution of the USSR in 1990, and that the U.S. has been working on this and was looking for an opportunity. And when the communists left in 1992, that was the time. But then the Mujahideen didn't pan out, and so they created the Taliban. And in fact, if you know, the United States came this close to establishing close relationship with the Taliban. They brought them here, delegation of Taliban,
right,
with the State Department. Robin Rafel went to Afghanistan and met with Mullah Omar. And so
and
they
the
brought
Taliban
them, showed them.
They traveled to the White House. They've traveled to Texas
to meet the oil companies and so forth.
Right, but they had some problems.
Nebraska University was started training in Kandahar for the pipeline, and this is 1996. So the pipeline has always been important, but also we need to point out that Afghanistan itself also has oil and gas, but more importantly, it has uranium. And uranium would be very important to U.S. economy. So the pipeline is fine, you know, because it would, Afghanistan would make about $100 million a year, which can help the Afghan economy. But if that's all there is, and if that was the motive, then that says something about the United States ruling class and the empire, just to consider countries either as gas stations or gas pipelines or whatever and not worry about the countries, you see. And so that is important. Now, the turning point or the knife's edge, if you don't like the knife's edge, we can say it is at a turning point. And that is unless and until there's quick, massive reconstruction, good reconstruction, economic justice, cleaning the corruption, doing away with the warlords and drug lords, bringing law and order and security into the country, Karzai having Afghan bodyguards, unless these things happen quickly, the country is in big trouble.
Can I ask one quick follow-up question?
Yeah.
How do we handle these warlords and people who have so much power and have had for so long?
We gave them the power. You see, that's we're responsible. Washington is responsible for that, you see, because as I said, Washington has been working. We train these people. We arm them. We hire them. They work for us. Anything that would fight, anybody that would fight the Taliban and Al-Qaeda is our friend. That's how it is. And we still use these people to chase because the United States doesn't have enough forces on the ground to be managing a country the size of Texas with 25 million people.
3 weeks ago, on a Monday, in Iraq, two British soldiers were arrested. Doing what? They shot an officer, an Iraqi officer.
In Basra.
And wounded another in Basra.
Yeah.
What were they dressed like? They had wigs on. Yeah. They had turbans on. They looked like Iraqis. Okay? There are top Iraqi generals swearing to their grave that Israel, okay, the Mossad in particular, and British troops and possibly some American troops are staging terrorism. This is the same thing that really happened with 9-1-1. Out of respect for my guests, we didn't make this a 9-11 show. 9-1-1 was an inside job. That is the truth. It was committed and executed by criminal elements within the United States government. And, you know, we're about out of time. We've covered a lot of stuff. Yes. Thank you, caller.
Thank you very
much. You know, throughout... go ahead.
Well, we also have this problem that if the United States is indeed serious about the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, these people still today operate from Pakistan. Why doesn't the United States put pressure on Pakistan? And when the Pakistanis bombed the London subways, why didn't the United States and Britain bomb Pakistan the way they did Afghanistan? So you figure it out.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Throughout the course of the show, as you're going to see on Outside the Box if you're new to the show, we cover the police state control grid. We talk about global government, the way the left and the right media don't want to talk about. You understand, what we're talking about is not Democratic or Republican. I'm not a member of either party. I'm an American, but most of all, I'm a human being. There's a lot of horrible things going on in the world, and our freedoms are being taken away, and our Constitution is being shredded, lit on fire, and spit back on our face every single day.
Well, we're happening. Americans, but we're also Afghan.
Right.
I mean,
we're
human
beings. Next week, Sadie Gregg will be on the show. We will be talking about national ID cards and the implantable microchip. Next week, Catherine Albrecht from SpyChips.com will be on to talk about her new book, Spy Chips, which is doing very well on Amazon.com. Thank you all for watching. I hope you learned something. Until next week, I'm Alex Ansary, reminding you, there's still a war for your mind. See you next time.
All right.
Good.